in the work session. And go to a work session on House Bill 2035. We have an amendment to 2035, and Janet, can you explain it to us?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House Bill 2035 was the bill that you had a hearing on earlier in the week that added the county service districts that are established to provide public transportation to the list of districts that are eligible for state agency mass transit assessments. This was a Lincoln County transit district issue, and belatedly they discovered that it Lincoln County was not technically eligible for funds that they've been receiving. What we didn't take care of before the meeting, but have now, is adding an emergency clause to the bill. That if you're not used to emergency clauses, they sound like it's a drastic emergency, but that's boilerplate language for the bill needing to take effect earlier than 90 days after session. And in fact, if without the emergency clause, the county would not be start receiving its funds until January 1st, 2004. So the emergency clause makes the bill take effect on passage, and passage means by both houses of the legislature plus signature by the governor. So that's what the amendment does, is adds the emergency clause so that if the Senate acts quickly on this, the county can be back receiving the funds. That's the amendment.
Is there any objection or any discussion?
Yes. Let me ask a minute.
The chair would move that amendment, -1, the amendment to 2035, be adopted without objection. So that.
Mr. Chair, I move the subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee on House Bill 2035 be rescinded, and that it be sent to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Representative Beyer moves the subsequent referral to Ways and Means Committee on House Bill 2035 be rescinded, and that it be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Hearing none. Those in favor of the motion as amended will signify by aye. Opposed, no. Ryan, would you call the roll?
Representative Beyer.
Aye.
Representative Dinkfelder.
Aye.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Greenlee.
Aye.
Representative Mabry.
Aye.
Representative Zahner.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Chair Brown votes aye. Motion carried. I'll be the things that came out of my county. I'll be the carrier on the bill. Okay, and with that, I'll close the work session and move into the regular part of our program this morning. Could I have John Rosenberg, the Department of Transportation? Morning, Doug. John.
Good morning, Chairman Brown and members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here. For the record, I'm John Rosenberger. I'm the Executive Deputy Director of the Highway Division for ODOT. With me today is Doug Tindall, who's the State Maintenance Engineer. He's going to assist me in answering any questions that the committee may have. We have provided for you a handout, a PowerPoint presentation that I would like to walk through. In addition, we've handed you a state highway map, which I will reference. The Highway Division is charged with constructing, maintaining, and operating the state highway system. It consists of about 7,500 miles. And included in that is about 2,600 bridges. And I know earlier or late last year you had a presentation from myself and Paul Mather on the state of bridges. We are intending to probably give you that updated presentation later on. We provide construction and maintenance to the system in about 100 different locations around the state. And if you can see from the map, the diversity of the system ranges from large bridges in Portland and on the coast to very historic bridges down along Highway 101, to one-lane highways in the town of Port Orford that access a lighthouse, a historic lighthouse. We also have a significant number of urban freeways, and the state highway system includes both the Interstate 5 and Interstate 84. While we're about 10% of the total road system in the state, we carry about 60% of the total traffic that's on the system, about 56 million vehicles each day. We also are key in the movement of freight. About 250,000 tons of goods enter the state on an average weekday, and more are transported around the state. The state highway system links shippers and markets. We connect the airports, the rail yards, and the ports of the state. And all of the industries in Oregon are affected and depend upon the state highway system for distribution of goods and services. Over the last 85 years, the Highway Division has adapted to a variety of changes that have been brought forward both by the Oregon Transportation Commission, the legislature. Previously, decisions were made primarily by the Transportation Commission with very little input from the public or other local governments. Over the last 5 years, the Transportation Commission has worked very hard to change the way we do business and how we identify projects. They created the Area Commissions on Transportation. There is a map attached that shows you the different area commissions or acts around the state. They assist the commission in prioritizing and identifying projects to go into the statewide transportation improvement program. That is the state's capital improvement program. Also, recent legislation, the OTIA program, has allowed us to do a variety of cooperative efforts with local governments. Local governments actually are building many of the OTIA projects. About a third of the OTIA projects are considered local projects run by the local agencies. In addition, we have joint operating agreements with many local governments to share equipment. In the case of Jackson County, we actually have co-located with Jackson County our maintenance facilities. We also have become much better stewards of the environment. We have a comprehensive environmental program where we work with state and federal agencies to ensure that our projects are built to sound environmental standards. That program has been quite a success. It has also allowed us to expedite projects getting through the environmental permitting process at both the state and the federal level. We also have created a number of programs to improve incident response to accidents. We have the COMET program, which I know many of you are familiar with. We have Trip Check, which you can go on the internet and get updated weather information or road information across the state. We also have road cameras if you're traveling and interested in what the Ashland Pass looks like going into California. You can click on the net and you can get up to the minute information on weather. The same is true of government camp and a number of other sites around the state. We also have an integrated ITS, integrated transportation system, particularly in the metro areas, ramp metering, where we've tried to get more out of the system, particularly during peak hours, tried to relieve congestion. And finally, the OTIA program, the bonding program, which the legislature approved last session, we have been able to create a delivery mechanism within the Highway Division where a significant number of the OTIA projects are going to be delivered through the consulting community, both from initial design through construction, right-of-way acquisition. The alternative delivery unit was created by taking vacant positions within the organization, changing those to contract administrator positions. So we were able to deliver about one-third of the OTIA program through this delivery system. Later, I think you will be getting a presentation from Matt Garrett on the OTIA program, giving an update on the projects. Highway Division is, we really have two primary programs. We have construction, and then we have maintenance. Construction are things like the I-5-217, the Medford Viaduct, which is currently under construction, Highway 20, which is the project the commission just identified as a federal earmark, and we are anticipating that we will be able to complete that project in the next 6 to 7 years. We have a maintenance program. That's our striping, slide repair, snow removal, pothole patching, signals, guardrails. And then we have special programs, snow park, the snowmobile program. Those are dedicated funds. We also have special programs like Highway 101, the scenic byways program, a bike and pedestrian program, and enhancement programs, and the historic Columbia River Highway program. The Highway Division is divided into five regions. We have about 2,500 employees in those five regions. I believe the area commission map you have also shows the five region. The five regions are responsible for the day-to-day operation of the system within their regions. We also have the regions are divided into areas much along the Act boundaries. We have 12 areas. Those areas and area managers are responsible primarily for project delivery. We also have a central expertise housed in Salem, our technical services branch, and our maintenance branch, of which Doug heads up. Although we do have a number of issues that we've been addressing for a number of years, and I'm sure that through this legislative session you will hear more about those. We have an aging system. We have a system that is the demands exceed capacity in many areas, and the projections are that those volumes will continue. It's projected by the year 2020 that the truck traffic will double on the system. And from the discussion on bridges, our cracked bridge problem is a significant problem, and if not addressed, could have a significant impact on the economy of the state. Another challenge is is capacity. We just completed an I-5 corridor study in the Portland metro area, linking with in cooperation with the state of Washington. That bridge report, or the I-5 report, identified that the I-5 bridge and the influence area of the I-5 bridge is key to the economic health of the state, and we will be continuing to work with the state of Washington to try and come up with solutions and funding for the projects that have been identified through that study. Stable funding is an issue for the department. Inflation is eating into our buying power. Alternative fuels are having an impact on gas tax, and those will continue. Another issue, and I know many of you have probably experienced from your constituents, access to state highways is a significant issue. And the challenge for us is the competing interest, the through movement of trucks and vehicles that are important to the state, and for firms like Intel, Columbia Sportswear, Nike, that need to move goods and services, competing with legitimate commercial interests, the Fred Meyers, the fast food restaurant industry that need access for viability. So we are continually working through those conflicts to make sure that we can serve both. But clearly, the through movement is critical to the continued viability of the economy of the state, and we are focused to limit or restrict access where we can to keep those through movements going. The another significant issue that we're facing deals with projects in the STIP and how they compete in the land use process of the state. In order to get into the state transportation improvement program, projects must go through, must be on a city or county's adopted land use plan. And that plan, it would have gone through a public hearing process to identify projects. Then as the STIP is updated on a two-year cycle, it goes through another public hearing process, including the going through the acts to prioritize which projects should be recommended to the commission. Once it's adopted by the Transportation Commission, as we get into actual construction of the projects, we still face significant hurdles in terms of permitting and the potential of projects, even though they've been well vetted through a number of processes, those projects still are subject to appeals at the local level. So we need to work very carefully to make sure that the projects we get into the STIP are projects that the public wants and that we can successfully get through the local land use process so we can get those projects constructed without delays. And we have had projects over the years that have been delayed either by appeals or the threat of appeals in a number of areas across the state.
Excuse me. Mr. Chair, can I, from the start of when they decide on a road project to get on a STIP and then till it's completed, how many years would you guess that takes out of curiosity?
Chairman Brown, Representative Zahner, I think it depends. Through the federal process, the EIS process, just getting the projects through the federal environmental process, on average nationally, I believe, is about 5 years and can go up to like 9 years. Once it's in the STIP is a 4-year construction program. And there's the preliminary portion, there's actual right-of-way and design, and then actual construction. So it can vary. A paving project could go very quickly in a couple of years. A very controversial project or a very expensive project like I-5-217, that probably took 20 years in terms of in order to get the funding. In that case, it was a funding issue.
Can we speed those follow-up, Mr. Chair? Can we speed some of those up, the permit process, or anything we can do to so it can happen in my lifetime, you know, when we decide on doing something?
Chairman Brown, Representative Zahner, through OTIA historically, highway projects have been a pay-as-you-go process, and primarily with federal money and state gas tax. The bonding program with OTIA has changed our delivery, and we are required to move those projects through faster. To do that, we've tried to identify projects that are less controversial. We've tried to streamline both our design process. We've used innovative construction techniques with the legislature gave us last session. We've done design build. The Medford Viaduct was a time and contract, not just low bid, but it's also how quickly we could get that built. The St. John's Bridge in the Portland area, it's the only cable suspension bridge in the state system. We used we pre-qualified contractors to make sure that they were qualified to do that work. So the legislature has been very helpful both in money in terms of ATIA and in allowing us the innovative contracting to try and speed some of these projects up. And we will be looking to continue that in this session. And I believe there's a bill to do that.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, John.
I guess on the final issue I'd like to raise is retirements within the system. The PERS issue certainly is having an effect on the Highway Division. We are losing expertise in the engineering and the technical fields. We are working with DAS to see if there is some relief that we can get so that we can bring some of those retirees back for more than the 6 months that's currently allowed under PERS. The legislature during Y2K actually allowed IS positions to come back for over a six-month period. So we're working with DAS, and I believe they are introducing a bill that would assist for at least the OTIA program to allow us to bring employees back with specific expertise. It's also we are moving the way we deliver projects. We are actually trying to move to more of using contractors to do more of the work, both from start to finish. ODOT has and the Highway Division has used contractors on a supplemental basis up until OTIA. With OTIA, we made a conscious decision to make part of that program purely consultant-based, and we are probably moving more to that. Ultimately, I think the director would like to get us to about a 50-50 between the work that is done inside ODOT by ODOT staff and work that is done by the consulting community.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gainwood.
Could I ask a question? First, could I ask, as a matter of personal privilege, I'm still kind of new, and there are a lot of terms that are going around, like STIP and OTIA and IS and EIS and a variety of others. It would help me if you would...
acronyms.
Yeah, if you'd spell it out a little bit for me as a part of my education. The retirement issue is a serious issue, and we are in a special time, I think, with PERS because of the uncertainty around it. But as a manager of a large firm, as you are, succession, particularly technical succession, is a very important issue. And I wonder if you're working on avoiding the problem 5 years from now and 10 years from now in terms of making sure the technical knowledge is backed up and not all in the head of certain key individuals.
Yeah. Chairman Brown, Representative Greenlake, we are looking at the succession planning both at our key technical staff as well as our managerial staff. So that is an issue that is very much in the forefront, and we are trying to make sure that we have the technical expertise and we have the right work for the organization so that we can get the right people in the right place and over the long term be very efficient in the way we deliver services.
Yeah, it is a combination of short-term and long-term efficiency issues. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
John, is there the firms and the out there to do the engineering and inspection work that traditionally I know was done within the highway department? Is there those firms out there in the public entity now that can fill in that gap? As you say, you're losing these personnel within your department.
Chairman Brown, members of the committee, yes. We have found that the private sector is very capable of meeting our needs. It's interesting, the loss in the state of Washington of their measure in November, there has been significant downsizing in the state DOT as a result of that, but there also has the consulting community in Washington was very dependent on Washington DOT for work. So there is a lot of expertise out there, and we have a request for proposal that we did for the OTIA program, and the OTIA is the Oregon Transportation Investment Act. And with that program, we have 10 different consulting firms that are doing work currently in design. We have about $16 million worth of design under contract right now, and that will equate to about $125 million worth of construction as those projects move into construction. We are in the process of doing two additional requests for proposals for consulting services to assist both with our bridge program and in moving projects, particularly local government projects, out. So I believe the expertise is there and the capacity is there to assist us.
And this is with Oregon firms, so we're not, we're creating jobs for Oregonians as opposed to Californians or Washington.
Representative Chairman Brown, these firms are local firms, although there are some out-of-state firms, and many of these are multi-state firms that have offices in all over the U.S. But
I know I have a friend that works for a firm, and I believe they're headquartered in Reno, Nevada, but he's working on projects for the state of Texas now, doing inspection work and engineering.
Chairman Brown, members of the committee, that concludes my presentation, and we're certainly open to questions if you have additional questions.
Questions, John? Representative Zahner.
These TV cameras, like this morning, I was watching Channel 12, and it showed the highways on the news, and it said ODOT Do they pay for some of those, or do we furnish those without cost? Or can you tell me a little bit about how they're able to use that? And anyway.
Chair Brown, Representative Zahner, we don't have the statutory authority to charge them. It's public information, essentially, because we collect it. What we are doing, though, because of the demand, everybody wants access to them, is we're trying to develop a strategy where the private sector TV industry, would provide a distribution center rather than coming into our office, which they're doing currently.
Doug, could I ask you to identify yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry. Jeez. I've only been doing this for about 10 years. Chair Brown, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Doug Tindall, State Maintenance Engineer for the Oregon Department of Transportation.
Is there any other questions?
Well, just to follow up, also, I know we buy advertising for ODOT on the television stations, so maybe can we do a little swap? If those stations are using our facilities, why don't we have them run some more free ads? I know they're probably doing some public service, but I mean, could we save some money there by utilizing that method?
Chair Brown, Representative Zahner, those ads for ODOT are public service along the public safety line. Public service ads, we're not buying them. So it's a matter of what our, I think where you're going is there a way that we can make money off of this? We've thought a lot about that, but there are, within our current boundaries, we have some restrictions in terms of what, or I guess it's not restrictions, we're not allowed to do advertising or sell advertising to make money.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Doug, did you have anything to add?
No, he did great.
Thank you. Could I have Ann Cook and Bill Wilkins, please?
Why can't we sell advertising?
Ann, I'll let you make the introductions there.
I'll do that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Ann Crook, Director of the Oregon Department of Aviation, and I have with me today Bill Wilkins, the Chairman of the State Aviation Board. The presentation which you're just getting before you today is, again, a PowerPoint presentation. I chose this format because I've got some, as you'll see, we go through a couple of kind of large format things that I wanted to make sure were big enough for you to see. This presentation, I'll start with just briefly talking about what the Department of Aviation does, and then the rest of it will be an overview of the aviation issues facing the state of Oregon this year, and I think by talking about those issues, you'll get a pretty good idea of how the agency deals with those. Oregon Department of Aviation provides statewide aviation planning, administers grants and improvement programs, advocates for the improvement of the aviation system, provides communication links between all the stakeholders, and by that I mean all levels of government and the users and the general public, manages and develops state-owned airports, assists in maintaining compatibility between aviation and other uses. So in a nutshell, that's what we do. Issues facing aviation in this year, this next slide is just a list of those. Commercial airline service, growing trend towards business travel using general aviation. Air cargo is the fastest growing segment of the industry. Oregon's aviation infrastructure, aviation security, and airport ownership. And we'll go through each of those in a little more detail now. Commercial airline service is the traditional airline service, what you think of when you go to the airport and get on a plane and fly to visit your grandkids in some other state or something like that. The communities currently served by airlines are Portland, Eugene, Pendleton, Medford, Redmond, North Bend, and Klamath Falls. There are several other communities that have had commercial air service in the past and would like to get it back, and there are others that haven't had it and would like to get it. I can't express enough that changes in the airline industry right now are really making this a challenge, so that even all of these seven communities that I named just now will be challenged in the coming year or two to try to maintain the service that they have. Major airlines are now only servicing Portland International. United has been in also Eugene and Medford for over 40 years, and they're now gone from those markets, and is also having a reduced presence at Portland International even. Of these seven that I've named, Klamath Falls, Pendleton, and North Bend are all in danger of losing their service. Right now they're only served by Horizon Air. Horizon is doing fairly well. In fact, they're doing so well that they're upgrading to larger aircraft and probably will pull out of the smaller community. So this doesn't mean that Horizon Airlines isn't doing well. It means that only larger communities can probably expect that kind of service in the future. The next page, I talked about how United Airlines obviously is having a diminishing presence. Alaska Airlines is looking to become the dominant carrier on the West Coast, and Horizon Air, the commuter, works with Alaska Airlines, so they're part of that process of pushing the other major carriers out. Again, all the currently served communities can expect changes in the future. In those communities that currently don't have service, and Salem is one of those, Newport is one of those, Astoria, are going to have challenges in the future. For one thing, there aren't really other airlines that are currently operating to even talk to about serving them. There are a couple of hopefuls. There's always talk about a startup carrier, but right now with the changes in the industry, all of the currently operating carriers are moving to bigger aircraft, and the smaller communities, or the ones like Salem that have pretty close proximity to another well-served airport, are just not the sorts of markets that airlines are looking to right now. I know that sounds a little bit gloom and doom, so we can talk about the alternatives a little bit. General aviation is...
excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm. Representative Greenlink.
Are you going to talk about alternatives? Is that a part of this discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Greenlink. Yes, I am.
Okay, thank you.
General aviation is one of the alternatives. General aviation is, and I've called that GA here, is typically everything that's not airlines and not military transportation. So when you hear the term general aviation or GA, a lot of times that's kind of has the connotation of being a recreational pilot flying for fun on the weekends. But in fact, general aviation is a very large portion of the industry that includes corporate travel and quite a bit of charter travel. And we're seeing a tremendous trend now for business travelers to move away from using the airlines and towards general aviation. And in fact, that's one of the causes for the problems in the airline industry right now, is that the business travelers are no longer willing to put up with the hassle factor with the airlines and pay the airline rates. In Oregon, we're seeing some of these new business models in general aviation. There's one that is operating airplanes that are located all over the state on a charter basis, but they have one centralized dispatch system so that it really works like a taxi service. You call them up, you get an airplane that takes you from where you are to wherever you want to go, and by having a network based throughout the region, can charge rates that are more similar to airline rates and not what has traditionally been expected to be the charter rate, which was kind of an extravagance. Another model that we're seeing more and more lately is fractional ownership, which is where really several people buy into airplanes, an airplane, and then have the use of that when they need it. So, again, that's a way to make the corporate jet type of travel or charter travel more efficient and more affordable for more and more people. So we're seeing more of that. What this mode offers is more options. You can leave at the time that you want to from the airport that you want to and go to where you're going without having to worry about connecting hubs. And then once you get there, you know, the community where you're really going might be 20 miles away from where the airport is. This way you can get to your actual destination. The security requirements are less and easier to get through and just less hassle.
And they operate under different FARs, do they?
Yeah, they do, Mr. Chair. Depending on what sort of system they're operating, there are a couple of different regulatory structures that they could operate out of. And all of that, I think, we'll see will be changing as well. Some of these benefits that general aviation is offering over commercial air transportation is different security requirements. Well, I'll talk about that in a little bit, but we're expecting that to change. And the chairman just mentioned that they operate under different regulatory environments. Now that I think the federal regulators are seeing this kind of shift, those regulatory environments might change as well. So the benefits may change. But in the meantime, this is a trend that we're seeing. What that means to us is that we're seeing more demand for our smaller airports than we have in the past, and we need to make sure we've got the infrastructure available to support this. The next slide, I don't have a lot on there, but I wanted to point out that air cargo is the fastest growing segment in the aviation industry.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Greenwood,
could we somewhere along the line have some presentations from the groups that are trying to take over for this? I mean, this must be a huge issue for the smaller cities, and it'd be very useful for me at least to hear some more information about how these cities are being served by the models that are. Let's put that on a list somewhere.
I don't see a reason we can't down the road. I think there's one provider so far that I know of. Just
major provider.
Yeah, one group that's doing this.
The Sky Taxi.
Yes.
System.
We could bring them back there, see if they'd be willing to come in and
be very interesting.
Give us some information on their operation.
Mr. Chair and Representative Greenlick, I think some of these communities would like to share their story about what it means to them to have or not have air service as well.
Yeah, it's sort of an economic development issue that seems to be very important in these times.
It is. Okay. Air cargo is the fastest growing segment in the industry. This is an area that the agency hasn't done a lot with in the past, and we expect to change that. We are now working on a major regional summit that will review air cargo needs in the region and how Oregon can make sure and get our share of the growth in the future. We're working with Port of Portland and the Federal Aviation Administration on that.
When you say air cargo, that's primarily into PDX.
Yeah,
other airports around the state.
Yeah, Chairman Brown, all over the state. PDX, well, there are different levels. I think that PDX can get some air cargo that may be going into Seattle right now, but definitely the smaller communities could benefit from an increase in air cargo as well. And in fact, one of the trends, one of these changes that we're seeing in the airline industry is that there are carriers that are making more money off the cargo now than they are on passengers, and so decisions are being made based on cargo, and then the passengers supplement that. That's a complete change in how the thinking has been in the past. It's always been passengers first, and then the cargo rides along, too.
Does that, to have these increases, does that require some improvements in ground transportation also in and around these airports?
That's part of exactly what we have to determine. I think that definitely at PDX it requires some improvements. At some of the smaller airports it may not require much.
Thank you.
The next slide then shows the Oregon aviation system, and I just wanted you to see this so that you can get an idea of what we're talking about. If you're not familiar with the aviation system, I'm sure that when I say airport, you're thinking of Portland International or maybe Eugene, but the fact is there are 100 public use airports in Oregon. So you can see with this drawing that they are located all over the state. This print is hard to read, so I won't try to describe what all the different codes mean, but basically all the dots on the map there are public use airports. Okay, so I'll talk a little bit about Oregon's aviation infrastructure. I'm very happy to talk about the three new funding programs that the agency has to support and develop our infrastructure. Until 2000, we didn't have any funding programs at all. So the role that the agency played was advisory and technical assistance and doing some planning work. But all funding had to come through either the federal government or from the airport sponsor itself. So we have these three new programs. One is our financial aid to municipalities program. That's a grant program that we operate. The second one is the federal non-primary entitlement program. That is a federal grant program that was made available through the federal Air 21 program in 2000. But we administer that for the Federal Aviation Administration in Oregon, or at least we administer a part of it to help make it available to the smaller communities. And then the statewide airport pavement maintenance program, which is funded out of a dedicated aviation fuel tax that this committee actually heard and approved in the 99 session. I believe that it was in the last session that I was doing this sort of overview for the Transportation Committee and talked about these programs, but how it was too early to tell the benefits of them. I'm very happy to say now that the next page we can see a benefit. This chart breaks out all of those 100 public use airports by category. I won't get into the categories specifically, though you could guess that category one are the air carrier, most complex, busiest airports, and down to category five. I need to add that Portland International is not included in this chart, and we did that mostly because the scale at Portland International is so different from all the other airports that it would...
Excuse me, Ann.
I'm sorry.
Well, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't mean to interrupt you in mid-sentence there, but I wanted to acknowledge... In looking at your aviation system, it comes to mind, and I don't pretend to be an expert because this was a city problem, not a county problem, and I didn't have to deal with it. But I've heard complaints from time to time in the Dalles of not having access to some available funding because the Dalles Municipal Airport was actually physically located in the state of Washington, just across the river. And so Oregon had the tendency to say, well, that's a Washington airport because it's the wrong state. Washington turned around and said, well, this is an airport owned by the city of Dallas, which is Oregon, so it doesn't fit our system. And recently they joined together with Klickitat County to kind of make a regional airport. And I see it's on your system or our system. Is that fish or fowl?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mabry, that is, you're very accurate there. That's an airport that's sort of caught on the river there and goes in between. We have never denied the Dalles Airport money from our system because they're actually in Washington, and mostly because of what I just talked about. Before 2000, we didn't have any money to give them anyway. Since that time, we have given them grants, and so we do include them in our system. I think the big issue there was trying to get money from the state of Washington as well. And I have had conversations with my counterpart in the state of Washington about finding ways that we can both work together to help this airport and not let them feel like they're in a no man's land.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair. Thank you. Ms. Cook, I have a question about, because you, and I'm not familiar at all with the funding sources for our airports, but when you talk about three new funding programs and you didn't have funding previously, I guess and I don't see a slide here that talks about your overall funding for airports and where they get their fees. So can you explain, Tammy, take a few minutes and explain where the jet fuel tax goes to, and is that distributed to airports throughout the state, or, you know, are they on their own? Is it the port that funds themselves? That would be really helpful if you could provide an overview.
Sure. Chairman Brown, Representative Dingfelder, thank you. That's a good question. A little bit later, I did talk about airport ownership, and that gets into it a little bit. First of all, let me just say the sources of revenue that are available to the agency are all dedicated aviation fees. We get no general fund or lottery funds at all. The lion's share of that comes from aviation fuel taxes, and most of that comes from jet fuel tax. So most of our resources really flow through the Port of Portland Portland and come from the airlines or other jet fuel users. In addition to those, we also charge a fee to register an aircraft in the state of Oregon, and pilots have to get registered. All of the proceeds from the pilot registration go to a dedicated aeronautical search and rescue account. We don't even spend that money. We collect it, and it's available for Oregon Emergency Management to carry out search and rescue exercises. So I've talked about the fuel taxes and our registration fee. And then in addition to that, we own and operate 28 airports. And so we have fees that come off those airports that we use. So then where they go to, we don't collect this money and then dole it out to different airports based on where the collections came from or anything like that. Basically, the money comes in. The revenues that we collect off of the state-owned airports go back into those airports. And any of these other airports that are operated by other entities do the same thing. They charge their own fees and then use those fees to operate the airports. So then the rest of the money we use to run our programs or to fund these grant programs or the different aid programs. So money isn't allocated on some sort of equation formula to the different places. They compete for them.
Okay. Just a quick follow-up. Sure. Thank you. That's really helpful. So, because I was under the impression there was some, like, equalization formula for airports. So it's basically they're competing. All of our public airports are then sort of in competition with each other for customers to try to keep themselves in business to some extent. I mean, they're self-funding. That's what I just want to clarify. That's what I'm hearing.
Yes, Chairman Brown, Representative Dingfelder, I should clarify that they're attempting to be self-funding. But except for the largest airports, they almost always aren't. They really rely, most of the airports really rely on federal funding for the bulk of their development funding. And then these new programs that the state has made available help them provide the match for the federal funding or do some other program, fund some other development that isn't eligible for federal funding. But yes, in fact, most of them, which are owned by cities or counties or other entities, are subsidized by the local government.
Okay, thank you for that clarification.
Mm-hmm.
And Aurora and Hillsborough and Troutdale, they're all part of a feeder system for PDX, aren't they? And do they get local funding for those? Is there any kind of local funding to support those operations?
Chairman Brown, no. Again, the way the aviation system is funded is the airport sponsor, which is the entity that owns the airport, provides the funding with some state and federal resources available. So it just depends on who the airport owner is. Aurora is owned by the state. Hillsborough and Troutdale are owned by the Port of Portland. And so those funding sources come through those different city of Aurora or the area around Aurora doesn't pay into any of the support of that airport at all.
And does the state in any way track the usage of those airports, the departures and arrivals each day? Is there any way to do that?
Yeah, Chairman Brown, actually there is. The Department of Transportation kind of pioneered a method that's used by most states about 25 years ago that uses acoustical counters, which that's a technical term for a tape recorder, that counts, listens to and counts airplanes taking off and landing for a couple of week period every year, and then goes through an analysis to come out with an estimate of what the actual usage is for that airport. And so we operate that program and come up with estimated usage at these airports that don't have towers.
How does Aurora and Hillsborough rate in the overall, how many, as far as departures and arrivals? Are they high, low, as compared to other airports?
Mr. Chair. Hillsborough and Aurora, Hillsborough has, I think, the highest number of takeoffs and landings other than Portland International in the state. And Aurora is in the ballpark of fifth or seventh behind that. A lot of these, the ones that you're talking about are general aviation airports, don't have commercial service, but have an extensive amount of business traffic. and a lot of those kinds of airports have more usage, more takeoffs and landings than some of the commercial service airports. They're busier airports, but just with a different kind of traffic.
Thank you.
Chairman Brown, follow up on that. How do you handle touch and goes where they're practicing? You know, I live by Aurora, so when I drive by, I see them. They just touch the runway and they go. Do you count those or do you not count those?
Mm-hmm. Chairman Brown and Representative Zahner, a touch and go counts as two operations because that's a landing and a takeoff, and we count it that way.
Okay. But how do you know which are touch and goes and which aren't touch and goes on your system? It doesn't matter.
If they one landing and one takeoff counts the same. And Mr. Chair, since there have been some questions around this issue, I would like to expand on that just a little bit. The whole question about airport ownership and making sure that the state resources are distributed equitably, regardless of whether the airport's owned by the state or a county or a city, is one of the issues that the State Aviation Board is planning to really tackle over the next year. That's something that's been, ever since we developed these funding programs, now we've heard some of Aurora is a good example. That's a busy airport that is funded by the state through our fees that we just talked about, but there are no local funding support comes into that. Is that equitable when we might look another nearby airport such as McMinnville, that the city owns that airport and the city has to choose between funding the airport or the library or the police department or different choices? So that's a difficult policy issue that the State Aviation Board will be tackling this year.
I imagine that protecting the airport environment from encroachment from development is a big issue. You get a lot of complaints regarding noise, the person that built their home at the end of the runway after.
Representative or Chairman Brown, yes, we do. And we actually get those all over the state, whether we own the airport or not. We try as much as possible to focus our efforts on, for example, ensuring that those residential developments aren't built off the end of the runway to begin with, rather than then dealing with the noise complaints afterward. But that is a big part of our program, and the land use compatibility is a major part of what we work on.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Okay, I'll move on past my bragging slide. I wanted to show you how the pavement condition has really markedly increased since we started our funding programs, and we intend to or hope to see that trend continue upward. So aviation security, I'm sure, is something on all of your minds. Since September 11th, 2001, the entire security environment for all of transportation really has changed. There's a new federal agency overseeing this all, Transportation Security Administration. There is now a federal security presence at all these seven commercial service airports in Oregon. Most of the security functions at those airports are federalized. Those are functions that had previously been either under the control of the airport owner or of the airlines that were operating that out of them. The funding for this new federal agency is still unstable. It still hasn't been decided exactly how it will be funded. That's worth watching because so far a significant amount of the funding for the new security regulations and for the operation of the agency has come out of aviation user fees, which have been dedicated infrastructure development fees. So that means we're taking away from the infrastructure development to provide security. Congress, I think, is working on that right now. And then this year, the new Transportation Security Administration is beginning now to turn an eye to general aviation and look at security requirements that ought to be applied across the board to general aviation activities. State Aviation Board was a leader in this area and held a statewide general aviation security summit on October 9th, so really just a couple of weeks after the incident on September 11th. And we're finding now that several of the recommendations that came out of that summit are being adopted on a national basis. So I think Oregon really was a leader in that area. But again, I think we'll see a lot of changes in 2003. And that's something we'll have to continue to watch. At least now we do have a Transportation Security Administration presence in Oregon, and there are local people that we can talk to ensure that regulations provide needed security without being overly burdensome. Airport ownership is the next slide, and we talked about this just a little bit. I wanted to show you that of the 100 public-use airports in Oregon, 32 are municipally owned, 28 are state-owned, and I wanted to point out that that is a little bit unusual. Most states don't own airports, or the airports that states own are emergency type of strips where there isn't any activity out there. There aren't people don't have hangars, or there aren't fueling services or things like that available on the airport. State of Oregon many years ago got into the business of building and operating airports, and so we're now in a little bit unique position compared to other states. 16 privately owned public use airports, 10 port-owned, 9 county-owned, and 5 other government-owned. Most of those other government are federal government, like BLM or Forest Service strips. But there's one that's noteworthy that I wanted to point out. There has been a law on the books for several years that allows an airport district in Oregon, but nobody has ever taken advantage of that. Until last November, the voters of Coos County approved an airport district to own and operate the North Bend Airport. So we now have one airport district in Oregon, and that's brand new. I think they're just getting themselves set up now. All right. For the next couple of slides, I'd like to turn it over to Chairman Bill Wilkins, the chair of the State Aviation Board, to talk about what the board is doing.
I am, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am Bill Wilkins, a resident of Corvallis, and I have been chairing the State Aviation Board since its inception. The statute authorizes 7 members for the State Aviation Board. Presently, the membership is, as you see it, Mike Barrow is from Medford, an original member of the board. Mr. Burrell is a multi-rated pilot. He's a commercial. Thank you. That's very kind of you. He's a commercial developer in the Medford area. Jack Loacker is the legislature. The original board had 5 members. The last legislature increased that membership to 7. Jack Loacker of Portland is one of the members that was added to the board. Retired Air Force officer, a aircraft owner and pilot, and an attorney, and a businessman, including a variety of interests. Carrie Novak from Redmond. Ms. Novak is the initials there says that she's a licensed airport executive. She is the manager of the Redmond Airport and an original member of the board. Ms. Novak has created, through her efforts, has helped create one of the real success stories in aviation in Oregon. Steve Shriver of Portland. Mr. Shriver is the director of aviation activities for the Port of Portland. That is, he's the person that's in charge of all the Port of Portland's aviation activities. He's a new member of the board, or he was one of the additional members of the board. Joe Smith, pilot, attorney, a longtime aviation involved from Portland, also a one of the newer members of the board. The vacancy is caused when Mike Nelson of Baker City resigned December of last year. Mr. Nelson was vice chair of the committee of the board and found that his personal business activities precluded him from continuing to take part. So we have one vacancy on the board. There's a substantial amount of aviation expertise on the board. It's also true that it's a very dedicated group of people who are quite interested in what they do, and they take very good care of the business. I've been a great group to work with. My own background includes aviation, both as an avocation and as a vocation from time to time. In case you're interested, the statute says that one or two, and it must be from east of the mountains.
One.
One must be from east of the mountains. We've had two east of the mountains, and of course with Ms. Novak we still have that. The statute also says that no more than four members of the board may be a member of any one political party. At the moment, the lineup is three Republicans, two Democrats, and one independent. State Aviation Board has we've been in existence 2.5 years now. Years now, we have completed revising policies and about our airports. The policies which we were revising were at least 20 years old, and there had been a generation gone by before there was serious attention to the policies. We've done that, and we're nearing completion of the whole set of policies around the airports. With working with the staff and the recommendations of the staff, we've awarded nearly $1 million in grants and airport improvements from the funds available to the department. We made it a practice early on to move the monthly meetings of the State Aviation Board around the state. As you can see from the slide, we've traveled to 15 different communities. That includes, of course, Portland and Salem. It includes Newport, Baker City, McMinnville, Roseburg, Medford, Hood River, North Bend, Astoria, Corvallis. We're going to continue. The next meeting will be in Kaiser. We intend to continue that. We have made a change. The statute that was adopted, amended as it was amended by the last legislature, does not require us to meet monthly as it originally did. It requires us to meet quarterly. We have continued to meet monthly, but we've now decided that we've gotten well enough into it that we've decided to meet every other month. So we'll be meeting every other month, but still moving around the state. We've sponsored a number of conferences. Actually, we got into that before the board actually came into existence. We had one which we called the Revolution in General Aviation, and general aviation is undergoing massive changes technologically as well as institutionally. We then sponsored the GA, the Security Conference, which Ms. Cook commented about immediately in the post 9/11 environment. We brought together people from all parts, including law enforcement, into that conference. And I think we were the first in the nation to do that. Most recently, we've had a conference on air service, how to get air service to your communities and how to maintain it. And as Ms. Cook's presentation has already specified, that's going to be an increasingly vexing problem for our communities, but one that the economic development of the state, the board, I think, firmly believes we must find ways to get increasing amounts of air service to our communities, especially the rural communities of the state. And then finally, something I think that not all boards do, the board undertook an intensive review of the management of the department, including a review of Ms. Crook's performance, and I'm happy to say that we found her to be a very good manager, and we're pleased to have her. It's a pleasure to be here this morning, and I'd be pleased to help try to answer questions if there's any of them about the board.
Thank you, Bill. I just want to make the comment, Mr. Wilkins, that you're to be commended for the generous gift of your time and expertise for aviation in Oregon and to the services chairman of the State Aviation Board. And
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I appreciate it.
It's been a great pleasure to serve and a privilege to be a part of it.
Representative Zoner.
Mr. Chair, Bill, what are some of the changes that you made in that 20-year-old policy? I don't expect all of them, but what are some of the major ones that you're working on?
The whole set of them, we did not have for our airports, we did not have minimum standards. That is, what people are required to do if they're going to operate on the airport. We didn't have those standards. So we went to a process where we used a national consultant to advise us at first, and then we went to extensive hearings, staff working day after day, week after week with the clients, the constituencies around, and have developed a set of minimum standards that apply to all the airports which the state owns. We've adopted policies that have to do with rates and charges, since we didn't have those. We now have those. We've adopted leasing policies, how we will offer leases on state airports. None of those, to the degree that they existed, they were all antiquated, and we've gone through and worked on all of those. Staff has been very, very excellent in that tedious job.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Thank you, folks, for coming this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, is there a reason why those two representatives are supposed to get
why you have we were just party?
I realize he's a Republican, one's a Democrat. But I mean, now that sounds, you know, look at Dame Culler and I. We're in good shape here. We get along.
But
I think
it's so far
control requires that. We ought to encourage it.
A little crowded over on
sorry,
the
Mr. Chair.
Was there any?
I think they're probably both pretty good.
I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2265. Janet, will you read or give us an explanation of the bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. Members, House Bill 2265 is at the request of the Department of Transportation with pre-session files. Agencies have the ability through the governor's office to use the pre-session file bills. Just a note that agency bills do, in this case, were approved. They started real early process with getting bills through each of their divisions, suggested that they go through a process of going through the Transportation Commission first, and then the list from the Transportation Commission goes through the Governor's Office and through the Department of Administrative Services. So these are the one of the bills, and we'll have a number of others likely that have gone through that process. This bill adds motor carriers, for the restructors, trucking industry, and rail to the list of areas of critical concern to the Department of Transportation and to the Transportation Commission. And there's a number of things that, for reasons for this, it doesn't have an effect in a practical way, but those areas were not listed in the statute as areas of critical concern. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Committee, you'll notice that the Department of Aviation is not part of that statement there, and I believe what year was it, Janet, they were removed from
1999 legislative session. The department or the Division of Aviation was made a separate department, so the Aviation Department is no longer part of the Department of Transportation.
Oh.
That was a separate agency. These are separate agencies that you just heard from.
Let's see. Could we have Bruce Warner and Nicole both up, and Larry Phipps, come forward, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Warner, the director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. I'd like to thank the committee for hearing this bill this morning. I think Ms. Atkins did a good job of characterizing the intent of this bill. It's essentially to reflect the responsibilities and priorities of the department. The history of this goes back a little bit, and I think the memo you have in front of you from myself indicates that this really came out of the 1993 bill, which reorganized the Oregon Department of Transportation to really reflect those various priorities and functional areas that were brought in over time, and cleaned up the books and made it clear that all of the areas of the department were a priority to the legislature. And in fact, they as you saw, had a specific area called Areas of Critical Concern for ODOT. And as you also mentioned, they did a good job of removing aeronautics as one of those areas of critical concern when they removed and created a new department. But in 1995, the legislature, through its action and a budget, transferred railroads and motor carriers to the department, but didn't add those functional areas as an area of critical concern for the department. So this bill is bookkeeping in some ways, but it also, again, is, I think, meant to demonstrate the department's commitment to a multimodal transportation system in Oregon. So obviously we are recommending that you support this bill and move it forward if the committee desires to make it clear that railroads and motor carriers are of critical concern to the department, and again make it clear to anybody reading the statutes that they are again an integral part of the Department of Transportation. With that, I would conclude, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Any questions, Representative Greenwood?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the five already there is marine pilotage, and I assume that's not only about pilots. Does that represent whatever marine interest you have?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlick, the pilotage board really does deal with the licensing and provision of pilots for the bar and for the rivers, and it also gets into rate setting to reflect the cost of that. But it does not get into all aspects of the maritime business. So the complete maritime regulation functions is not part of the department. A lot of it is due to the desires by the federal government to retain control and oversight of those areas.
May I follow up, sir?
Follow up.
It seems odd that marine pilotage has the same status of critical concern, although I understand the concern for marine pilots, but compared to transportation and transit safety, is it required to be at that level? Or?
Mr. Chair, again, Representative Greenlight, this was meant, if you remember, as I said, they had taken all of the various functions that were put into this department in 1993 and, again, made them an overall statement that they were of critical concern. I think that the main gist of the discussion back in 1993 was there was a great worry that because the predominance of the department's funding is on the highway side, that some of the smaller portions of the department would not get the priority and attention that they needed. So I think the legislature was making a statement to the department that they need to be considered important and need to be considered in all of the work we do. Obviously, you're asking a question, is it of critical concern? And clearly the marine pilots in the shipping industry utilizing the bar and the Columbia River would say that these are of critical importance. And frankly, they do not get the attention that some of the other larger parts of my organization receive just because of funding and interest. But I believe it is a critical area and should remain as a critical area for the department.
Thank you, sir.
Representative Meyer.
Thank you, Chair. I understand this is probably more of a policy statement, but does this play out at all in the budgeting process?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Beyer, the budget process is where all of these things are brought together as part of the department, and it means that we will be there supporting all of these functions, and again encouraging you to fund those areas adequately. But I think you're right. It's a policy issue. It's a statement of priorities for the department, and the budget is ultimately where the decisions are made about funding and priorities in those particular areas.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, just one quick clarification. Bruce, I was looking at your org chart that you gave us a few days ago, and so these positions, I mean, basically these are already in your staff. It's part of your organization, and this is just institutionalizing that change.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nick Felder, that is correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Director. Appreciate it. Larry, you want to go ahead?
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. My name is Larry Phipps. I serve as the president of the Oregon Short Line Railroad Association, and I'm here to urge your support of House Bill 2265. The Oregon short lines are particularly important to the transportation network within Oregon. We operate over half of the 2,400 miles of railroad within the state. We serve more than half of the shippers within the state, and we handle over a half million truckload equivalents of freight each year. We need to ensure that the short lines a contribution to the state's transportation system is recognized, and we feel that having a knowledgeable advocate such as the head of ODOT Rail within ODOT is important to the railway industry, and in particular to the short lines. Clearly, we see that the railroad transportation is an area of critical concern, and would like to see it included along with those other means and modes of transportation. Thank you.
Thank you, Larry. Is there any questions? Seeing none, I guess. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That's it.
Yeah, I have one little thing to say.
Okay. Before we go into work session, I'll Jen has some comments to make on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to point out, and this is kind of a follow-up to Representative Dingfelder's comment, that the agency was not limited by these lists previously, because on line 12 you'll see, and on line 19 in the bill, it says not necessarily limited to. So they, again, that they haven't been doing anything that wasn't within the policy statement existing, but this is just a again, bring those in for consistency and priority.
And with that, I'll close the public hearing, and we'll open a work session on House Bill 2265. Is there a motion?
So moved.
Representative Greenleck
recommend do pass.
Moves that the make the motion that House Bill 2265 be sent to the House floor with a do pass recommendation. Is that the motion?
That's the motion, sir. Thank you. Right. Thanks for your instruction.
Is there any discussion?
I wonder about that.
Could you write that down for me so I can use it again?
Okay, I blocked that one.
I know.
Yeah, I know. Those in favor of the motion to send House Bill 2265 to the floor with the do-pass recommendation will signify by aye. Those opposed by nay. Ryan, will you call the roll?
Representative Dingfelder.
Aye.
Gilman.
Aye.
Greenleck.
Aye.
Mabry.
Aye.
Zahner.
Aye.
Beyer.
Aye.
All right. House Bill 2265 passes. Need a carrier. Any volunteers?
I think we should have Representative Greenleg since.
Sure, let him start on that.
Part of the learning experience, right?
Okay, thank you. Representative Greenleg will be our carrier.
Can you get the first bill?
Probably not.
Yeah.
The first bill article.
Open the public hearing on House Bill 2215. And Kelly's on the... Yes, we have any witnesses? Morning, Kelly.
Morning, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Kelly Tater with the Department of Transportation, and House Bill 2215 was another bill that the department requested to be introduced. We see it as a big improvement in customer service and our efficiency, and also a way to increase the accuracy of our records. Basically, in today's world, change of address has to be done either in writing or by person. And so when we're helping people over the telephone and they tell us, oh, by the way, I've got a new address, let me give that to you, we say, can't help you. Let me send you a form. You fill it out, mail it back to us, and then we'll enter it to your record. And then we'll send you the sticker for your license. And they're like, what? What do you mean? I just talked to such and such private company, and they did this. And I say, well, unfortunately, the law says in writing or in person. So this bill would allow us to offer a more convenient method, in addition to in writing or in person or on the web page, for people to tell us a change of address. And we think there's some advantages to that. It's obviously going to be less frustrating to the customer if we can help them with a one-stop shopping sort of approach while we're helping with other business. We think people will be more likely to turn in the change of address. Sometimes when you get a form a week later in the mail, you may set it aside and not get around to ever doing it. So by us capturing the address when we're talking to the person on the phone, we'll update our records faster. That's better for law enforcement. That's better for us. That's better for the driver because their records are more accurate. And also, when we send them that change of sticker to put on their license, we send them the motor voter registration card that we're required to do. So it may actually increase voter registration because, again, it gets to them a little faster while it's still fresh in their mind. So we believe it's a good bill. It will help. I looked at the stats. There's about, in a biennium, about 120,000 people that this could help. That's quite a few happier customers, less frustration, and we certainly don't want to have people go into the DMV office unless they really need to. So I would ask the committee to support the bill.
Thank you, Kelly. Is there any questions? Representative Dinkel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Kelly. So you said 120,000 change of address per year?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dinkfelder, that's ones that we'd be helping over the phone. We do hundreds of thousands more than that.
And do you have the capability to do that online? Is there the capability to do that online at all?
Mr. Chair and Representative Dinkfelder, sort of. We're improving that. There is on our webpage a form for you to fill out after some checks to make sure it's really you. It's a form you fill out. But then it's then entered to the system, and we're improving that so it will actually take it and then update the system automatically versus having to print it out and have a data entry operator enter it. So it's a little slower method by now, but it is accessible to you at the web page, yes.
Okay, so that's currently available?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Representative Maker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My understanding, I hope, is correct that this doesn't specify a specific way we handle, but gives you the flexibility of patterning it and adjusting it to make sure it works, and therefore we can look to you if you have a problem.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mabry, exactly. This does take the specificity out of the law, so it's not so nailed down, and if we have a problem, by rule, we can adjust it by rule. It is to give us the flexibility, yes. Thank you.
Kelly, is there any concern about security, with the ID cards?
Mr. Chair, since 1997, when the Federal Driver Privacy Protection Act was passed by Congress and then each state, and you all passed it in 97, our whole business has changed with how we help customers over the phone, because we must make sure, a list of information from them to make sure who we are talking to. So there are safeguards in place with information we have that we get from the customer to make sure we are talking to truly Kelly Taylor. And Kelly Taylor will only be allowed to change Kelly Taylor's record. She will not be able to change her husband, Wes Taylor's record. And so there are safeguards in place. The business has changed drastically since 97 in order to protect people's privacy. And the other thing to remember is what the person's getting back through the mail is not a new license or ID card, but simply a sticker to put on the existing license or ID card in their hand, much like they would have gotten through the mail if they'd filled out the form.
Any more questions of Kelly? Yes, not. Thank you, Kelly.
Thank you very much.
With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2215 and open a work session on House Bill 2215. Is there a motion?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to make a motion to pass House Bill House Bill 2215.
Representative Dingfelder makes a motion that House Bill 2215 be sent to the floor with a two-pass recommendation.
I guess we need to take a vote first.
Is there any discussion? Hearing no discussion, Ryan, those in favor of sending House Bill 2215 to the floor with a two-pass recommendation will signify by yes. Those opposed, no. Ryan, will you please call the roll?
Representative Gilman.
Yes.
Representative Greenwood.
Yes.
Representative Mabry.
Yes.
Representative Zahner.
Aye.
Representative Beyer.
Yes.
Representative Dingfelder.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries. House Bill 2215 will be sent to the floor, and we need a carrier. Representative Gilman, thank you. And I think that concludes our business for the day. But there's Janet would like to make some announcements about Friday.
I'm rusty.
Yep. Okay.
Mr. Chair and members, since the field trip is scheduled for Friday out to the maintenance shop, because of the floor session being moved to 8:30, the decision was made yesterday to move the beginning of the meeting time for the field trip till 9 o'clock. So you may have to come directly from the floor to the front steps out here, and we'll be picked up and transported out there. It's only about a 10-minute trip, and we should be easily done by noon or before and back here at the Capitol. We did call your offices yesterday, so they should have that on your calendars. We may be joined by a few members, either Senate members or members from the Ways and Means Subcommittee. They also may have a conflict and may not be able to join us, but they've been invited. I didn't know if there was any questions.
I've been assured we're going to get a ride out on a grader. Rather
than back on the grader.
Oh, back on the grader. That's right.
And I've been told to remind the chair not to wear a tight skirt.
I won't. I'll wear a Levi's.
Chair.
The chair? No tight skirt, Mr. Chair.
Is there any other questions? Okay.
No, you wouldn't like to see. Can we vote on that?
No objections, we're adjourned today.
What a rowdy committee this is.